Is life always sacred? Is a birth always a blessed event? Morality is about behavior that honors life in its fullest sense, not its lowest. And so is the morality of abortion. These are hard and emotionally loaded questions that we're asking this morning. There will not be unanimity of opinion on them, but then there isn't any Sunday. But if important and emotionally loaded questions can't be raised in a church, it's not a church worth attending. We gather to ask hard questions and sometimes to dare to suggest that we and our society might need to look at important issues in entirely new ways. And that willingness is part of the reason that we can say, as we do every week, that it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Will the children please come up front? Okay, I want to tell you a story that I don't think you've heard, because I wrote it. And at the end, you get to vote. Sometimes you get to vote on stories, and this is one of them. This is a story about a girl who loved hamsters. Do any of you have hamsters?
I don't.
You don't. Okay, all right. All right. Do you have hamsters? You used to have 22? You may know this girl. How many do you have now? One. You may know this story. Well, this girl loved hamsters, and she finally, after badgering her parents for a long time, talked them into buying her hamsters, and they did a good thing and a not very smart thing. The good thing they did was get her a hamster, and the not very smart thing they did was get her two hamsters. That's how you started, wasn't it? You got two girls? You must have added something else somewhere. Well, she started with two, and they weren't sure what they were for long. But after a while, they were sure, because she didn't have two hamsters anymore. She had 10. Hamsters are very friendly little creatures, and they make more hamsters very quickly. But this was fine, because the girl loved hamsters. And it's a good thing she did, because before too long, she didn't have 10 hamsters anymore. She had 100. That was fine. She loved hamsters. And she told her parents, you know, now that I have so many hamsters, which are sort of getting out of the cages and running all over the house, we need to buy more cages. And we probably ought to buy our food in 5-pound bags. So they did. And she brought it home to her hamsters, now in a larger number of cages. But she didn't have 100 hamsters for long. After a while, they never die. After a while, she had 1,000 hamsters. That's a lot of hamsters. And they got out of the cages, and they were running all over the house, and they were in the beds, and they ran out from under the pillow at night when you were asleep, and there were hamsters everywhere. But that was all right, because the girl loved hamsters. So she said to her mother, you know, the problem is we need bigger cages and more cages, and maybe we ought to put them out in the backyard under a special roof, and we probably ought to start buying our food in 55-gallon drums. Big barrels, those big metal barrels. So they did that, and she had all of her cages, and she had aisles between the cages, but now feeding was such a chore, she had her friends help her. They'd sort of roll wheelbarrows through the aisles and throw food into the cages for the hamsters. although of course she didn't have 1,000 hamsters for long. Before long, she had 5 million hamsters. That's a lot of hamsters. Oh, that's a lot. Well, they got all over the house. They got all over the town. They ran down the streets. They ran in other people's houses. They were in everybody's bed. They ran out from under everyone in town's pillow when they were asleep. They did. They went to the toilet too. That's right. I'm not going to be talking too much about that, but they did that too. Every day. And now a town meeting had to be called because a lot of people were concerned about all these hamsters. And the girl said, well, I just love hamsters, and so what we really need to do in this town, we need to build a boat. And I've thought about this. We need a boat, a really big boat with a lot of levels, and we can put it out on Town Lake. And then I can have all my hamsters out there on the boat, and they won't be in your houses, and they won't be under your pillows. And I can have a little rowboat, and I can row out every day to feed the hamsters, because I love hamsters. Well, I don't know how she did it, but she convinced them. And they built a boat. And I mean, this is a boat that made Noah's Ark look like a little rowboat. This is a big boat. And they put her 5 million hamsters out on the boat. And every day, she and then eventually some other friends would row out in their rowboats. And you really couldn't climb onto the boat anymore to play with the hamsters. There were too many of them, and they were too eager to get the food. And they got a little nasty when they got close to you, and they'd bite. So they would sit out on their rowboats and they'd shovel hamster food up over the edges of the big hamster ship. And there was no one left to count the hamsters anymore since you really couldn't get close to them. But you could get a feel for how many they were by watching the big boat and how much lower in the water it was riding every day as the weight of the hamsters and their other activities increased. So many hamsters, yes. And the big boat was sinking. And people in town began watching the big ship out there on Town Lake, riding lower and lower and lower in the water as the number of hamsters increased to Lord knows how many million. And finally, one day, the boat sank. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And almost all the hamsters drowned. Well, this was very upsetting to the girl who loved hamsters, so she called another town meeting. And she said, the problem is, we need a bigger boat. Now, you'll have to close some schools and lay off some social services to be able to have the money to build a big boat, but I really love hamsters. So I need you to buy me a big boat to put them on. Okay? Now you get to vote. You're at the town meeting, and they want your allowance is going to be cut, too, if they build this boat, by the way. You're going to have less money to go to the movies and to buy candy and things. What do you think? Should she get a boat, a bigger boat, for more hamsters?
No.
No? No, why not? She loves hamsters. And just have one. She should give them away. A 1,002 cages. So you still wanted to have a lot of hamsters. You wanted to have two. Well, that's how she started, of course. You wanted to have one. This is... You wanted to have none because she'll have nothing to take care of. Don't you think she took care of her hamsters well? A puppy! This is very good, all right? What do you think? Males and females in different cages. No visiting hours? And a few visiting hours, yeah. Well, what do you think? She should build her own boat. Maybe she should live on it. I don't know if she loves them that much. Well, as you can see, this is a very complicated problem. Dale does. She wants more. She wants more. And another boat. A bigger boat. This is a very complicated problem, and I thank you very much for listening to it and voting. I think the adults have learned a lot from you this morning. You can go to your classes now. For over a generation, America's cultural liberals have treated abortion as a matter of individual rights, where the mother, but not the baby, is seen as a rights-bearing individual. Conservatives have countered by claiming rights for the baby, though the law hasn't recognized a fetus as an individual whose rights can cancel the mother's rights. That may change. On March 5th, this past Tuesday, the Bush administration published a proposed rule designating embryos and fetuses as children eligible for medical benefits under the state Children's Health Insurance Program. The pregnant woman herself is not considered a patient, only the embryo or fetus. This is a brilliant and creative extension of individual rights designed to negate a pregnant woman's rights by pitting her against the fetus and putting the government only on the side of the fetus. It may be evil, but it's brilliant. It will be defended as a caring act by those who say they love children. Is it? Or is it a cynical tactic to disempower women, to help remove them from the workplace where they frighten weak men, and to tie them to caring for children they do not want in an economy set up to treat the desperate children of desperate women as minimum wage workers without any significant choices? Is forcing the birth of unwanted children caring? Is caring really that easy? Or do caring and loving human beings demand more of us? These are our questions this morning, and I invite you into them. Odd, even jarring, to have a responsive reading from Khalil Gibran's lovely piece on children, and to sing songs about the spirit of life in a sermon where we're talking about the morality of abortion. If we cannot keep our tender mercies and our care present in this subject, then we do a disservice to the subject and to ourselves. I noticed after the first service, someone took my sermon off the music stand. It won't work. I know this subject. I found an earlier small print draft that had the two quotations that I'm going to need later. I'll wing the rest of it. People in the hard sciences sometimes mock people in soft, squishy fields like religion, ethics, and morality because the hard sciences can actually describe what really is in ways that theologians and ethicists and moralists can't. And they're right. That's why I like religion, ethics, and morality. There are much harder subjects where we are trying to talk about what should be and trying to make persuasive arguments for why they should be. No religion worth being called a religion can go far without failing to ask whether the gods we're worshiping are worth worshiping. Our problem is that we worship too well, but not too wisely. The same is true in ethics and morality. All kinds of social customs and habits get established and called ethical and moral, which cannot stand under scrutiny when asked whether they are worth enshrining at the center of a personal or a social moral code. Each kind of life has its own peculiar kind of excellence that it's able to unfold into. And moral questions always have to be framed against the background of the peculiar kind of excellence available to that species. with lower forms of life, we don't expect a lot of them. Generally, they're reduced to only two sorts of strivings: survival and breeding, self-preservation and the propagation of the species. Flies, ants, bees, jellyfish, lobsters. We don't talk about them developing their higher characteristics and capabilities. Maybe lobsters do, I don't know. We just see them as surviving and breeding. And if they survive and breed, they're a successful species. Not true with humans. We demand much more of people. We demand that people be able to do the kinds of things that only humans can really aspire to do. And both ethics and morality are judged in their adequacy by how well they support this. And the worthiness of the gods we serve is judged by how well they support helping people become the most they can be rather than the least they can be. Now, there are a lot of ways that human life gets degraded. It can happen through a bad totalitarian government, whether the government of Stalinist Russia, the killing fields of Pol Pot in Cambodia, the regimes of the Afghan Taliban, or the regimes of the fundamentalist version of the American Taliban, as made clear by Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson after September 11th. And the symptoms can come from any part of this complicated picture of a human society being degraded rather than elevated. The symptoms may be economic. What may be most obvious about bad times are that people have been reduced to desperate workers without choices. The symptoms may be simply overbreeding, and the problems of overbreeding and overcrowding. You want to see this? Go to Chicago and look at Cabrini Green or the Robert Taylor homes and see what happens when you stack desperate and hopeless people on top of each other. The symptoms can come up in different ways at different times, but they always all go together. Overbreeding, powerless and desperate workers, and people with no choices who are reduced to a level too low to be defended as something we can be proud to call human. Now we're ready for Pope Leo XIII and his amazing encyclical of 1891. I think it's some of the best thinking the Catholic Church has produced, and the Catholic Church has produced a lot of very good thinking. I know there are people who say, why would anyone listen to the Catholic Church's pronouncements on sex when the only sex their priests have is illegal and immoral and has resulted in over $1 billion of lawsuits for child molestation? These are not the moral spokesmen on the subject of either sex or responsibility. But at their best, they've produced some stunning moral and theological thinkers, and Pope Leo XIII in this encyclical was at their best. In 1891, the symptoms were exhibited in labor. Many people had been reduced to desperate situations where they simply had no choices and had to do whatever they were told in order to earn enough to live. Children were being worked in coal mines at the age of 8 years old, and they would work there until they died, often at a young age. Workers had no unions, had no power, had no voice, and had no choices. Those who controlled the money demanded of them whatever they chose and gave them as little as possible. This was the situation when Pope Leo wrote his encyclical on the condition of labor, and in doing that, he reversed a position the Church had held for centuries. The Catholic Church for centuries had taken an immoral position in these fights by siding with the wealthy against the poor. And they had done it by finding a proof text from the Bible to justify their position. What's a proof text? A proof text means you've already decided what your conclusion is, and now you go hunting through the Bible for a text that will support it, and you ignore all those that don't. That's why people don't trust theologians or respect theological arguments. A lot of them shouldn't be respected. The text that had been used for centuries by the church came from Genesis, after Adam and Eve were expelled from the garden in the Genesis myth. You can say they were expelled by wanting to be informed and developed rather than ignorant and obedient. I could be editorializing. The line that was used is the line that the writers ascribed to God, where they had God say, "By the sweat of your brow, you shall live." And anyone raised here in a conservative church knows this line and knows that the interpretation given to it, and I think it's an odd interpretation from a God who had, according to the story, created these animals. The interpretation given to it is, see, life is miserable, unfair, nasty, brutish, and short, and that's God's plan. So suck it up. That's what God's plan for you. Get used to it and praise the Lord. This had been used for centuries to justify working conditions and living conditions that were minimal subsistence conditions. What Pope Leo did that was brilliant and tactical was to use the same passage from the Bible, but to point out that it had been misinterpreted. That the wrong word had been accented. And when you accented the right word, it not only changed everything, but it made it far easier to believe that this is the wish of a loving God. By the sweat of your brow, God promised us, you shall live. Live how? Like bugs? At a level so low and mean and nasty that you have no choices and no chance ever to develop? Is that what the God who created the species wants for it? No. By the sweat of your brow, by an honest day's work, you shall live as human beings with all that meant from a loving Creator God. Otherwise, you're just living like animals, like brutes, and that's not what you were created for. The Pope contrasted humans with brutes, and with all due apologies to brutes, this is what Pope Leo wrote about brutes. See if this description sounds familiar. The brute has no power of self-direction, but is governed by two chief instincts. These instincts are self-preservation and the propagation of the species. But with humans, it is different indeed. It is the mind, or the reason, which is the chief thing in us who are human beings. It is this which makes human beings human and distinguishes them essentially and completely from the brute. I'd add that it's also our moral sensitivity and our ability to make distinctions and discernments that, as far as we know, lobsters and dolphins don't make. And what's the role of the church in all this? The church's desire, said the Pope, is that the poor, for example, should rise above poverty and wretchedness and should better their condition in life, and for this it strives. And if the conditions existed which robbed humans of the possibility of living like humans rather than brutes, if people found themselves, as this Pope wrote, in conditions that were repugnant to their dignity as human beings. Do you know of any such conditions in the world? Where people have found themselves in conditions that are repugnant to their dignity as human beings? If health were endangered by excessive labor or by work unsuited to sex or age, in these cases there can be no question that within certain limits it would be right to call in the help and authority of the law to do what is required for the remedy of the evil or the removal of the danger. And why? Why must the church and the law do these things? Because God demands it. Demands it because humans must be given living conditions which allow them to develop as fully as humans can develop, to the limits of their potential as educated, intelligent, creative, and joyful people. It's for that reason that they were created. And conditions which make that impossible are not only wrong, they are evil. That's the basis of the theological argument in this amazing encyclical. In this encyclical, Pope Leo established himself as one of the bravest and most creative theologians of Christian history. The other point that's important to mention is that this 30-page essay changed the position and the direction of the Roman Catholic Church in areas where it had held the opposite position for centuries. The fact that it's a long-standing habit or tradition doesn't mean it's right, doesn't mean it's moral, and doesn't mean it needs to be followed for the future once we can see better and think better and care in bigger ways. Now we can bring this full circle. Times have changed since 1891. And one of the things that's changed is that the population of the world has doubled twice since 1891. 2,000 years ago, when the New Testament was being written, the population of the entire world was estimated at about 200 million, about two-thirds of the population of this country today. Over the next 1,900 years, that's a long time, the population of the world doubled three times, to 400 million, to 800 million, and by about 1900 to 1.5 billion. Three times it doubled in 1900 years. It doubled again in the next 60 years. And by 1960, the population was 3 billion. We were breeding without thinking. We were breeding irresponsibly and blindly. And in the next 39 years, by 1999, it had doubled again to over 6 billion people on the world. Overbreeding is now one of the conditions that makes it impossible to live both on large scale and small scale as human beings, and is now one of the conditions that must be opposed, not because it's wrong or selfish or greedy, but because it is evil. Quantity of life has always been opposed to quality of life. What Pope Leo did in this encyclical was to turn the Catholic Church to a position that endorsed quality of life over quantity of life. The mere fact of being alive was not adequate and not sufficient for a church or for moral people to affirm. That is not what God wants. God wants, to keep it in theistic language, quality of life and the highest quality of life for people, and any condition that stands in the way of this is evil. Not just socially wrong, it is evil. This is not a matter of individual rights. I was always unhappy that the abortion question was framed in this society as a matter of individual rights. That's not adequate. And it leaves women who chose to have an abortion for good rational reasons still feeling emotionally frustrated and raw because the discussion didn't address the fact that it was also a moral decision for them to have an abortion. And it was. Let's look at some. A 15-year-old girl is pregnant with her second or third child. She's addicted to crack cocaine. She lives in a place where it's easier for her to stay on welfare than to get a job, not that she could get much of a job anyway. What is a young girl with two or three children and no education going to do? She can be a prostitute, her boyfriend can be a pimp, or a drug pusher. and they can all take drugs to numb the pain. This is not what human beings were created for, and conditions which force them into it and make it likely that it's the level that they will fall to are evil conditions and immoral conditions. 20-year-old woman is a college student. She gets pregnant because she and her boyfriend weren't careful. He wants to marry her and have the baby. He wants to be a father because it's his baby in part. She doesn't love him. She doesn't want to marry him. She doesn't want to be a mother. The abortion is probably the only moral decision she has to make. What about adoption? Why not force her to carry this pregnancy to term and give it over to people who want to adopt? I have two adopted stepdaughters who were Korean girls. I know what a blessing loving adoptive families can be to children without homes. Why is it immoral to force a woman to carry a pregnancy to term? It is immoral because it is immoral to turn a human being into breeding stock for more privileged people. It is immoral. The presence of loving adoptive parents is a wonderful blessing in a world that has already produced too many children through irresponsible and immoral breeding practices. It cannot be used as a reason to turn powerless women into breeders for more privileged people. That's a sin. I'm not trying to answer all the questions. The subject of abortion, unwanted pregnancies, raises many questions that take many heads and many good discussions to pursue, and we need to pursue them. I'm just trying to sketch a moral framework for understanding breeding and abortion that can let us discuss these questions from around a new center. The girl who thought she loved hamsters did not love hamsters. She didn't even know what love was. She was obsessed with her own fetish to observe the presence of an unlimited number of desperate, struggling bodies for which she had no responsibility. That's not love. That's immoral. It's hard enough to learn how to love hamsters. It's much, much harder to know what we need to do really to love people. And it's much, much more important.